The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello and good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call, coming to you as always from sunny Singapore. Well, it's the 21st of November 2011. And we are here for the hour, and I hope you are all getting ready for your nice Thanksgiving weekend. We will be here as always on Friday, so if you have nothing else to do while you're waiting for your stomach to settle, you can do worse than to switch on and listen to me, hopefully, at 10 a.m. on Friday morning in the usual way. Well, I'm sure many of you will have seen photos and videos of the recent police brutality in Oakland. Police in paramilitary gear, pepper spraying a bunch of innocent kids curled up on a sidewalk. And a 96-year-old lady, by all accounts, so I didn't see that. Did you take a close look at those shields they wear all over their faces? You know, a police state in the USA can only take hold with the acquiescence of the people. Well, I'm here to tell you that prerequisite has been met. The Patriot Act, the Department of Homeland Security, the groping of children and senior citizens at airports, the wiretaps, rendition, torture, the expansion of wars and assassinations, up to the suppression of Occupation Wall Street protests. Oh yes, all this is part of the historic record. Most recently reconfirmed with the acceptance of police violence in several cities inflicted upon the Occupy Wall Street protesters. Acceptance, of course, being the absence of tens of thousands of citizens in the streets demanding arrest and prosecution of the police officers who committed violence. But you see, like the bankers, the mortgage brokers, and the other criminals, these people have gone uninvestigated and uncharged. The number of American people demanding justice is minuscule. You see, people are cool with the government wiretaps, with any and all manner of anti-terrorist action, even torture, with mass violence and death in the deserts above oil fields far from home. And now, people are cool with mass numbers of riot police to quash peaceful protest, dissent, free speech. For complete nonsense reasons, sanitations, curfews, time limits numbered in weeks, hurting small businesses and normal commerce, any other nonsense Bloomberg's lawyers come up with, the tolerance of stupid failed wars, so many historians and philosophers have told us, goes hand in glove with acceptance of decreased domestic rights. And now we're seeing this linkage for ourselves. The riot gear-clad cops are dispatched, not just for drug busts, not just for riots, but for small, peaceful protests, frequently for the purpose of intimidation, nothing more, nothing less. Airport security is engaged in behavior control, ham-handed enforcement of unquestioning obedience, having nothing to do with stopping a terrorist bomb. Now, tactics of the powers that be include centrally planned suppression of the Occupy Wall Street movement, possibly by the Justice Department, Department of the Homeland Security themselves. But you know, the escalation of police and security acts against the populace is only the symptom. The real sickness is the acceptance of the creeping police state. I'm afraid to have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that the people are cool with it, by and large. Yep, these are the same people who had no trouble re-electing all the clowns who extended the Patriot Act, or the president who had just lied to them about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Even so-called Tea Party candidates who liked the idea of government security powers voted yes and got returned to Congress. The percentage of people who are not troubled by squads of riot gear-clad thugs swinging batons and peaceful protesters, that is what counts. That is the one and only way the police state, growing and festering in the United States of America, can possibly continue. Apparently, rampant consumer consumption wasn't enough to satisfy the need for comfort. Order, routine, and security from discomfort became more important than rights long ago taken for granted. Quaint rights, like freedom of assembly, of speech, of religion, not to be stopped and frisked. Rights that people delusionally believe will only be infringed upon for other people. The criminal, the terrorist, the political loon or extremist. People are more infatuated with stomping on the rights of others who are deemed undesirable than they are in love with rights for everybody. They think their personal rights are immune. You know, people wonder why a civilized, politically aware, intelligent, well-educated people like the Germans allowed their country to be taken over by the Nazis from 1933 to 1945. By 1933, Germany had suffered humiliating defeat in 1918. Economic privation as a result of the peace treaty, crippling hyperinflation and currency failure in 1923. 10 years of economic depression before the US Great Depression even started. And things went from horrible to much worse. A decade of escalating political violence, deadly violence on the streets of major cities, political assassinations numbering in the tens of thousands. And that violence was not monopolized by the rising brown shirts. Communists, socialists, monarchists, police forces, private militias, public militias were all shooting and killing one another in the streets. You know, frankly, it's hard to blame a people drained by 15 years of all this, that they were willing to trade a few freedoms in return for some long-denied security. What's America's excuse? Exactly what is America getting in return for allowing or cheering the violent suppression of protest by riot cops? The quiet acceptance by millions of Americans, and active approval by millions more Americans, of the suppression of political dissent with violence has convinced me. The decay into a police state is not going to stop. It is now too late. Oh, sure. Americans will rise up one day from their torpor, but not until they're starving. And if any of you did see the video of the Oakland police in front of the Occupy Wall Street protesters over the weekend, you will see that no regular American is any kind of match for these thugs. Forget everything you've been told about self-defense and arming yourself against the enemy. Your only defense, ladies and gentlemen, is emigration. All right, let me give you the information, as always. I'm Richard Martin, this is the Wake Up Call, and if you would like to call in, please feel free to do so. And the number is 888-874-4888. That is the toll-free number to call the show anytime during this hour to speak to company present or to ask your questions. Again, the toll-free number is 888-874-4888. And if you would like to email me, you can do that too by emailing rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. And please feel free, you can email me anytime during the hour, and I will make every effort to get to your question today, and if I should fail to do so, then hopefully it will come to you on Friday, and there will be a live wake-up call on Friday. Okay, if you want to call me in private to talk about your personal issues, please feel free to do that. My number here is 941-441-1682. And that's 941 in, that would be in Sarasota, Florida, area code 941-441-1682. And by the way, while talking about police action, wars, and the like, I am absolutely horrified to see that Obama was in Australia last week, assuring the Australians that they're about to receive a huge influx of American soldiers, American Marines, will be coming to take up residence in Australia to take care of the threat from China. Now, you may or may not know this, ladies and gentlemen, but the distance between China and Australia takes us very close to Singapore, as the crow flies. And I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that if I find out that either Singapore or China, or rather Singapore itself, is taking sides on one side or another of this particular problem, my wife and I will be emigrating. We will leave Singapore because, quite frankly, it's one thing to look up in the sky and see American bombers flying overhead ready to bomb China and Chinese bombers flying overhead ready to bomb Australia. It's quite another thing to have them bomb Singapore on the way. And I don't think that Singapore actually will take sides. I think they learned their lesson in the 1940s when, because of their status as a British colony, when America came into the war with Japan, Japan immediately trudged down through Malaysia and occupied Malaysia and then occupied Singapore. So Singapore knows what it's like to be a part of a skirmish which they have nothing whatever to do with. My hope is that they will retain neutrality in the like of Switzerland during the Second World War. And that will be the end of the story. And I think it's very likely that they will. So I'm not too worried about Singapore deciding to take sides in this conflict, because there will be a conflict, ladies and gentlemen. I will be back with more stories, more updates. But I assure you what happened last week was a major step in the direction of massive conflict between the United States and China. You are bound to hear a lot more about that as time goes by. All right, now what I would like to do is to play you the clip of Ron Paul, who was on Face the Nation this weekend, and it seemed to me important not so much because of what he said, although what he said is interesting, But since Ron Paul is now neck and neck with the other Republican candidates for the primary in Iowa, which is much better than he's ever done before, clearly it felt it beholden to CBS to give this man some exposure, from 89 seconds to a full 7 minutes on Face the Nation. Seems to me like a bit of a leap, but it was nevertheless considered that they wanted to do so. And the reason I want to play you this clip is because I want you to listen to the interviewer, who is, I would say, not on the boundaries of rudeness, but actually stepping into a rude and insulting framework as he questions Ron Paul and virtually ridicules what he has to say. The clear implication, and this is what I want you to take away from this, is that, as always, the mainstream media go all out to make you believe what they want you to believe, and they dislike Ron Paul, and they do not want you to believe his proposals, which Ron Paul lays out very succinctly in his piece here. Quite frankly, it's a failure on the part of the mainstream press to do this, and I think that his exposure, I don't know if he was on any other program this weekend, but certainly his exposure on Face the Nation will have given him all he needs now, in my opinion, to pull away from the crowd. And suddenly, I think, as of Sunday, his chances at the presidency have taken immeasurable leaps forward. So do listen particularly, as I say, for what the interviewer has to say and how he says it and how he cuts Ron Paul off and how he tries to ridicule him. And with that, let's go to the clip of Ron Paul on Face the Nation.
And good morning again. We begin this morning with Congressman Ron Paul. The polls, Mr. Paul, suggest that you are now in the thick of it out in Iowa, basically in a statistical tie with Romney, with Kaine, and with Mr. Gingrich. So I want to ask you some questions now that you're among the front runners. We need to know more about your positions on the issues. And I want to start with foreign policy, because your statements over the years, posted on your website and elsewhere, some of the things you have said in the debates, suggest that you believe that 9/11 happened because of actions that the United States took. Is that correct?
Well, I think there's an influence, and that's exactly what the 9/11 Commission said. That's what the DOD has said, and that's also what the CIA has said, and that's what a lot of researchers have said. And just remember, immediately after 9/11, we removed the base from Saudi Arabia, so there is a connection. That doesn't do the whole full explanation, but our policies definitely had an influence, and you talk to the people who committed it and those individuals who would like to do us harm, they say, yes, we don't like American bombs to be falling on our country, and we don't like the intervention that we do in their nations. So to deny this, I think, is very dangerous. But to argue the case that they want to do us harm because we're free and prosperous, I think is a very, very dangerous notion, because it's not true.
Well, I would question the import of what some of those commissions found that you cited there. But basically what you are saying, Mr. Paul, is that it was America's fault that 9/11 happened, and it was our fault that it happened.
No, I think that's a misconstruing of what I'm saying, because America is you and I, and we didn't cause it. The average American didn't cause it. But if you have a flawed policy, it may influence it. When Ronald Reagan went into Lebanon, he deeply regretted this, because he said if he'd have been more neutral, those Marines wouldn't have died in Lebanon, because the policy was flawed. The same thing that McNamara said after the Vietnam War, and he wrote in his memoirs that, you know, if he would have changed, if we don't learn from our policies, it won't be worth anything. So I'm saying policies have an effect, but that's a far cry from blaming America.
Well,
I mean, in America, you're supposed to be able to criticize your own government. You're supposed to be able to criticize your own government without saying you're un-American.
But
that's what the implication is.
But what you are saying, it was the government's fault. That that basically is what you are saying. Let me move on to from something else.
I'm saying the policymaker's fault.
The policymaker's fault.
Contributed to it.
All right.
Contributed to it.
Let me ask you this. Am I correct that your idea of how to discourage Iran from building nuclear weapons is to be nicer to Iran's leaders? Is that correct?
Well, I think to be, we have 12,000 diplomats. I'm suggesting that maybe we ought to use some of them. But just think of how we prevented a nuclear war with the Soviets when the Soviet missiles were put in Cuba. We didn't say we're going to attack you. Kennedy and Khrushchev talked, and they made a deal. You take your weapons out of Cuba, we'll take them out of Turkey. That's the kind of talk that I want. I think the greatest danger now is for us to overreact. And this is what I'm fearful of. Iran doesn't have a bomb. There's no proof. There's no new information, regardless of this recent report. And for us to overreact and talk about bombing Iran, that's much more dangerous. We got the Libyans to get rid of their nuclear power and their nuclear weapons. And look at what happened to them.
So, Mr. Paul, we got to understand that. May I interrupt just for a second? No one has suggested in the U.S. government that we are going to bomb Iran. What they have said is that we're going to impose very tough sanctions. You are against sanctions on Iran. Is that correct?
Yeah, because sanctions are the initial step to war. I was opposed to all the sanctions for 10 years and the bombing that was occurring with Iraq, as I said, it would lead to war. But if you say nobody's suggesting it, why don't you listen to the debates?
Mr. Paul, may I correct you? I am listening to the debates. I know there have been some candidates who've talked about that, including Mr. Romney. The United States government has not said we're going to bomb Iran. I mean, That's just a fact.
No, obviously they haven't said that, but the implication is nothing is off the table. You've heard those statements.
Well, yes. All right. Let's move on then. Do you think there is any place in the world where United States forces should be stationed? You've talked about bringing them home from Afghanistan, from Iraq. Is there any place where you think it helps us to have U.S. forces stationed?
No, other than the fact that I think a submarine is a very worthwhile weapon, and I believe we can defend ourselves with submarines and all our troops back at home. This whole idea that we have to be in 130 countries and 900 bases, now they've just invented a weapon that can hit any spot in the world in 1 hour. What's this idea? This is old-fashioned idea that you have to keep troops on 900 bases around the world. It makes no sense at all. Besides, we're bankrupt. We can't afford it anymore.
So you would, if you were president, you'd bring home the troops from Japan, you'd bring home the troops from South Korea? You would. Okay.
Absolutely, and the people are with me on that, because we can't afford it. It would save us a lot of money. All those troops would spend their money here at home. And besides, those troops overseas aggravate our enemies, motivate our enemies. I think it's a danger to our national defense, and we could save a lot of money cutting out the military expenditures that contribute nothing to our defense.
All right, let me ask you about some domestic things. Your plan to get the country back on a firm financial footing is to close, including among other things, the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, Commerce, Interior, Housing and Urban Development. You would cut back the federal workforce by 10%. You've also suggested we should close FEMA, which is the Emergency Management Agency. I have to ask you this. What do you do about all the things that those agencies control, run, supervise? For example, what happens to the national parks if you close the Department of the Interior? Do we just let them go by the by, or what?
No way. And the program deals with this. There's transition funds, but we would like to see a lot of land sold off, but we're not going to just ignore the parks. No, not at all. I mean, the money isn't there. These are departments that are doing too much. The American people are sick and tired of our educational system. Just think of how we've been involved and give out loans, and we educate students. The cost of education goes up. They graduate. They don't have jobs, and they have $1 trillion worth of debt. We have to question that. This country's in bankruptcy. We have to deal with it. We can't remain in denial. And that is my argument, and believe me, this is why I'm getting a good reception on the campaign trail.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for coming on this morning and for answering the questions. Ron Paul, thanks for being here this morning. We're going to shift gears now and talk about what's going on in Washington.
Well, I think you would agree, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, I'm not exaggerating here. I mean, this man, Bob Schieffer, who I've followed in debates before, I've always thought he was very fair, a very reasonable person. He's always been very good in the moderating the candidates in the final stages of the campaigns. I'm stunned to listen to this man basically ridiculing Ron Paul and interrupting him and treating him like a kind of child. It's absolutely the mainstream's intention to get this man out of the campaign. If I was Ron Paul, I'd be scared. I know that Kane has requested a Secret Service detail. I would strongly recommend Ron Paul to do the same thing. Who knows? Anyway, I thought that was interesting, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll bring you more of the same as and when it comes up. Okay, well, we've got a few minutes before our break, so let me see if I have thing here on the email. Yes, dear Richard, this is from Al Berry. Why are treasury bills from the United States with very high debt better than treasury bills from governments with no debt, like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Singapore, Norway, Switzerland, Chinese renminbi, Sweden, treasury bills? Thank you, Al Berry. Good question, Al. And I think the easiest answer is that if you are American and living in America, and you are buying treasury bills, the yield on a treasury bill is so small that you're basically buying American currency. And you, if you're going to start buying American currency in all these other countries, Al, then you are really taking a risk of an adverse move with the American dollar against all those currencies. Now, in the old days, when you could buy, you know, an Australian government bond or a Canadian government bond with a 5 or 6% yield, that was very different, because then you could afford to take some risk with the currency. But my contention is, as I told you before, that the dollar is going to make a considerable move up. So if you go out buying Australian treasury bills or Swedish treasury bills, and you lose much more through the exchange rate differential than you do gain in any other way, then it's not going to be very helpful to your case. And that's one reason why I really would not diversify into foreign currencies. As far as the safety of the treasury bill is concerned, you are going to have plenty of warning before I am going to be coming to you saying that you should not buy treasury bills or you should sell your treasury bills. They are the U.S. government's most senior debt, and they will be the very last thing that the government defaults on. So I think you're fairly safe. In addition, as you know, treasury bills are very short-term paper. They are usually 180-day maximum duration, so you really don't have much of a duration risk. Or a maturity risk. So they really do make sense. But anyway, thank you very much for the question, Al. And let's now... I've got something from Steve Canero, which is a little complicated. I'm going to need to read through that one. So let me take an email which I received the other day. I see that Al's email was repeated again. I just had a look at it again. Okay. So, I got an email from Jeff Burns, who says, "Dear Richard, I downloaded all your program from the PRN archive during the last 2 years, and maybe even a little longer. Your clarity of financial issues is remarkable." Thank you very much, Jeff. "I am part of the Wall Street protest movement. I am working on a one-page handout flyer about bank crimes and how it hurts the populace. I have extracted some information from your audio files, and I'm trying to weave it into the flyer, into my email messaging, and into the General Assembly's exchanges that enhance our grasp of the bank grievances. Our goal is to awaken the slumbering masses of Americans who have been deluded and misinformed for decades. Occupy Sherman Oaks, plus Occupy San Fernando Valley, plus Occupy Encino are the groups that I work with. You can see the two of them on Facebook. Check out the photos and posted articles if you have a little spare time. Your feedback is welcome. If you can, would you help construct a paragraph on bank crimes that we could circulate among our groups? And may it serve as a document that we can use for public instruction. Many people sense that something is wrong. They have vague ideas about origins of problems. They have heard a few terms like bailouts and credit default swaps, which are meaningless to them without a good context. Unfortunately, the sinister intentions of media controllers prevent full disclosure by the media. Our movement needs some catchy phrases and slogans for our hand-carried signs and some paragraphs, about 3 to 6 sentences long, to include in our email updates. Anything that you can contribute will be accredited to you. Thank you for all you do, Jeff Burns. Well, Jeff, I'm afraid that I don't have that in spare time you're talking about, but I hereby throw this open to any of the listeners, and if you'd like to help Jeff out, here is his email. Let me give it to you. Please get your pens and paper ready, and here it comes. Jeff Burns, or one word, now that's J-E-F-F. Jeff Burns, B-U-R-N-S. That's J-E-F-F-B-U-R-N-S, 777. So that's Jeff Burns, 777, at gmail.com. Once again, that's Jeff Burns, 777, at gmail.com. Okay, well, good luck, Jeff. I hope you get some responses to that. I shall be hoping to get some feedback from you as and when. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take our break, and I'll be right back. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. Anne McKithen, I want to apologize. This, I think, is the third week where I have failed to reproduce your email, which is a request, and I shall do so right away before I forget, without further ado. It comes from Anne McKithen, who lives in Texas, who says as follows. Hey, Richard, I sent you an email which asked if you have any listeners in my area who might want to start a meetup group for getting out of here. Please mention my request on your show. Texas, well, maybe not holding out too much hope. The glass is half empty, getting to that point, as always, Anne. P.S., that's Houston, Texas, or surrounding area, willing to drive. So that's Anne McKithen, and I will spell her name. That's Anne without an E, A-N-N, M-C-K-I-T-H-A-N. Anne McKithen is her name, and her email address, for those of you in the Texas area who would like to get together and maybe start a meetup group, the email address is AMCK, and that's obviously for Anne McKithen, AMCK22 at gmail.com. Again, that's the email AMCK22 at gmail.com. Once more, AMCK22 at gmail.com. Who are the 21 previous Anne McKithens who have accounts at gmail.com, Anne? I'm curious. If you know any of them, perhaps you could bring them into the group as well. Who knows? All right. Well, I came across a really, really fun piece, a really good piece by Jim Kunstler. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you are aware there are some people whose writing I follow very avidly. One of them, of course, is Bill Bonner. Another is Jim Kunstler, and on the rare occasions when they come up with something quite spectacular, I try to bring it to your attention. And this is one such article, came out this week from Jim, and it's called "The Blue Bus is Calling Us." So here goes. These European politicians and economists all sound like rocket scientists with all their charming Euro chatter. But they must be quite dumb to machen such an unglaublich scheiße Sturm of the System Financier. Kekadzo, eh? Surely all the pretending nears its dire conclusion. everybody is broke and everybody is in hock up to his prefrontal lobes, and everybody is whirling around the drain over in the grand continental theme park of lovely cities and great eats. I'm sorry, but I don't see how they can stop the hemorrhaging as we slide into the season of holiday enchantment. Every bank and its uncle is dumping everybody's sovereign bonds as though they were discovered to be croissants imported from a leper colony. Fait. Folks of all stripes and accents desperately seek to move their money to some safe harbor. But where is this cozy mooring? To the U.S., for the moment, perhaps. But what happens Monday morning when the markets react to the weekend news that the U.S. Senate Super Committee has been utterly unable to agree on decisive action that would forestall the scheduled massive automatic budget cuts built into this red, white, and blue doomsday machine, not to mention the ratings agency's threats to knock UST paper down another notch upon such failure? Oy, oy, oy. Just to be plain here, nothing is working. The global system of accounting control fraud has completely unraveled. Nobody will lend money to anybody anymore because everybody suspects everybody else is lying about their ability to meet any obligation. The whole world has become a daisy chain of schnorrers and schmicklers. All those hundreds of trillions of dollars in credit default swap insurance. Ah, worthless and pointless. Because now that a Greek default of at least 50% officially has failed to ignite a payout, then no default will. Instead, you'll just get cascades of unhedged defaults. All the lawyers who ever lived could litigate until the sun turns into a red dwarf, and they will never resolve these swindles. And the money represented in them will be so far gone that not even Ray Kurzweil in full singularity mode will encounter a trace of it in his eternal travels through a zillion parallel universes. So much for the hedge fund industry. I hope the folks who ran those cute operations enjoyed their years in Fairfield County, Connecticut, and Saddle River, New Jersey, because in a few weeks they'll be disguising themselves as OWSers in some makeshift urban encampment in order to line up for three-day-old bagels. Personally, I look forward to test-driving a few $5,000 must-sell pre-owned Lamborghini Sesto Elementos. Not that I'd actually buy one. The Nimble might even score some bargain beachfront property in the Hamptons. It's been about a fortnight now since John Corzine's MF Global Fund went up in a vapor, including a reported $800 million or so, rumored to be actually more than like $2 plus billion, filched out of clients' portfolios that cannot be accounted for, though there are additional rumors that it constituted a batch of collateral that was liquidated a microsecond after its arrival at J.P. Morgan, which had lent Corzine's firm enough money to buy the rope that it hung itself with. Notice the story has completely disappeared from the mainstream news media, while the Kardashians soldier on. Even poor Gerald Celente, chief of the Trends Journal Forecasting Group, arch-nemesis of the White Shoe Boys, got snookered in the action when MS Global somehow ended up with custodial care of the gold ETFs Gerald was collecting, and his ship just vanished. I heard him fulminating over it on a podcast, and he is not somebody I'd want to be on the bad side of. Up until now, Celente was only commenting on the prospects for revolution in the streets. Now, I dare say, he'll be out in front leading it, or perhaps rappelling down Jamie Dimon's security wall with a straight razor clenched in his teeth. The MS Global case has fast-tracked the evaporation of trust in all the places, large and small, where American one percenters stash their cash. The redemption orders must be flying through their transoms like radioactive black swans. By lunchtime tomorrow, this could include all the TBTF banks. That's what the pundits mean by contagion. Where will that money go now, if they can get it out? I don't see where else it can go now except to shiny yellow and white metal and maybe some oil positions. But the mechanisms of the precious metals trade have also been monkeyed with, and you'd best be careful where you place your order. As for oil, if lending really does seize up, then letters of credit would not be issued and tankers will not be moving any product. More to the point, the global revolving debt system has depended on colossal transfers of ultra-short-term borrowed money. If short-term borrowing is simply unavailable, things could go south very quickly. And by that, I mean food stops arriving at the supermarkets, which hold just a three-day supply. Wouldn't that make for an interesting Thanksgiving? I have admittedly painted an extreme picture this week, but this week presents the most extreme convergence of events the world has seen since September of 2008, and perhaps a good bit worse. Excellent stuff, Jim. Keep up work. Fine job there. All right, let's have a look. A couple more emails appear to have come through here, so let me pick them up and see where we go with them. Dana Cooper wrote in saying, you mentioned Ponzi schemes in relation to Treasury bills, so why would we want to buy Treasury bills? I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, Dana. Mentioned Ponzi schemes. Treasury bills are Treasury bills. I mean, basically, if you have the Treasury bills in your possession or bought through Treasury Direct, which is what I always claim is the easiest, cheapest, and best way to do this, Ponzi schemes shouldn't really make a difference to you. You actually do have the bills in hand, and they are fully redeemable at the end of their period, which is, as I say, maximum of 180 days. So I wouldn't be too concerned about Ponzi schemes. It's not like you're buying into some kind of a fund. Although I will say that a United States government Treasury bill money market fund is also an excellent way to hold these things. Again, as I've always said, be careful to check inside or under the hood, as they say, in order to be sure that that the fund really does contain exclusively Treasury bills, not some kind of other fancy products state enterprise stuff, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, that kind of thing. But failing that, your Treasury bill money market funds should be fine. All right, Gilbert wrote in saying, hi, Richard, quick question. Gerald Celente recently lost his investment held by MF. How safe are we that have investments with Charles Schwab or other such institutions? Thank you for your generosity, Gilbert. Well, Gilbert, I think the answer to that is that commodity futures firms are a different kind of investment vehicle than our stock brokerage firms, for the simple reason that when you buy a commodity future, you have to put up money from your account into the commodity exchange itself in order to cover the contract, because you're really buying a contract which states that you will agree to deliver a certain product, or you will agree to take delivery of a certain product on a certain date or by a certain date. So you're asked to put up a good faith deposit of something which can range from 7 to 8% to about maybe 15 or 20% depending on the volatility of the product. Now, it's a very different thing from buying a stock where your money is held in escrow for you at a stock brokerage firm until such time as you come to buy that stock. That money is, by law, segregated from the rest of the pile, as it were, and many of you will say, yes, well, I thought that was supposed to be the same thing also with MF Global. The answer is yes, it was, but we had a rogue CEO there who just basically stole the money. At least that's what's alleged, and that's what it's beginning to be looking like more and more as time goes by, and the very poor bookkeeping of MF Global appears to have elicited none other than what must be seen as pure theft. This is very unusual and certainly nothing that we've really been accustomed to hearing about in any other kind of financial institution in that respect. I'm not saying that money hasn't been filched in other ways, but the pure lifting of funds out of customers' accounts in the way it appears to have been done in this case is very unusual, and I don't think it's something that you should concern yourself with. I think it's very unlikely that this is going to happen. I didn't ever have very good things to say about John Corzine, the CEO of MS Global. I talked about him a lot back in, I think, 2005, when he was racing down the streets of New Jersey at 91 miles an hour and getting away with it, and doing a lot of other illicit things at that time, kind of time, too. So he's a no-gooder, somebody you want to stay away from, and certainly somebody in whose company you do not wish to invest. Hopefully that has done justice to the question, Gilbert. And so I will move on. Well, here's an interesting thing I came across the other day from the Journal of Consumer Research in a brand new study that talks about credit cards, which I thought was an interesting slant on the credit card approach. They say that credit cards take us out of our right minds. A kind of euphoria is induced, which makes people ignore the downsides to purchases. And this is what is the meat and potatoes of a new study in the Journal of Consumer Research. It says, like a starry-eyed new lover who ignores the downsides of an obviously incompatible but very attractive partner, consumers who swipe plastic when they buy are often blinded to the true costs of their purchases. They even tend to exaggerate the perceived benefits of whatever they're buying. According to research by Promo Sesh Chatterjee of the University of Kansas and Randall L. Rose of the University of South Carolina. To put it another way, buying things with credit cards is more like lust than love. Buying with cash, however, makes people focus on the pain of a purchase, not just the costs, but other downsides of the purchases, such as a product's limitations. And quoting from the authors in the report, our research suggests that when it comes to product evaluation, beauty truly lies in the eyes of the cardholder. End of quote. Well, the research might help consumers get a better grasp on why they seem to overspend when using plastic. It has broader social implications too, particularly as new and even more frictionless payment systems like Google Wallet enter the marketplace. It may also help consumers understand exactly how large corporations are trying to exploit their behavioral weaknesses so that they can develop their own personal countermeasures. It's long been observed that consumers spend more when paying with plastic than cash, a phenomenon known as the credit card premium. But there hasn't been much research devoted to why, according to strategy. It's generally been presumed that consumers who feel the pain of dollar bills leaving their hands spend less than those who zoom through checkouts with just a swipe. But Chatterjee argues that something much deeper is going on, and I quote, the effects of credit cards go far beyond increasing consumer spending power and shifting consumption from the future to the present. Fundamental product perceptions are affected as well. End of quote. And I've always said to you, ladies and gentlemen, get rid of the cards, get rid of the mortgages, get your debts down to a minimum. And I have always made a little bit of an exception for the kind of cards that offer you goodies once you've purchased so many thousand dollars worth of product. They send you free things through the mail, or you get free air miles and things like that. So it does make it a little bit difficult. For those of you addicted to credit cards, it's a bit like those of you addicted to food. You have to eat food to survive, and you have to use credit cards to get the goodies. So I'm not quite sure what the answer is on that one. But anyway, the researchers primed subjects using traditional behavioral study methods, such as making them play word games, which focused their attention either on credit cards or cash. Then they gave the consumers information on items they could theoretically buy, such as a notebook, computer, or an iPhone. Repeatedly, consumers primed to think about credit cards had a harder time recalling products, price, or other downsides. And I quote from the report, "Our findings suggest that marketers may be affecting not just the amount of money consumers are willing to spend, but also the true nature of the goods and services that find their way into consumers' market baskets." Well, researchers primed subjects using traditional behavioral study methods, such as making them play word games, which focused their attention either on credit cards or on cash. Then they gave the consumers information on items they could theoretically buy, such as a notebook, computer, or an iPhone. Repeatedly, customers primed to think about credit cards had a harder time recalling products, prices, or other downsides. So, apparently, it hits even Chatterjee himself. He says, "I hardly ever carry cash, and as a consequence, I keep buying things I don't really want. I'm not even thinking about the cost. I'm so consumed with the benefit of what I'm getting. It's been bugging me for a long time. People don't realize how their payment mechanism influences behavior." End of quote. The research is even more relevant as new touchless forms of payment become common, such as cell phone payments, enacted like Google Wallet, enabled by near-field communication chips. The pain is missing when consumers make such effortless payments, and that prevents them from engaging in otherwise normal cost-benefit analysis before they acquire things, according to Chatterjee. Apparently, new electronic payments allow consumers to make payments without a lot of deliberation. This arrangement, ostensibly for the consumer's convenience, seems to offer an even more powerful disconnect of spending from payment, again, according to Chatterjee. Retailers have conducted high-level research on consumers' behaviors for decades, of course. For example, something as simple as making product containers taller distorts consumers' perception of volume and therefore compromises their ability to comparison shop. But credit card euphoria is so powerful because it can impact literally every kind of purchase, according to the new research. Something as simple as the display of a MasterCard or Visa logo on a cash register could actually nudge consumers to buy more stuff, Chatterjee thinks. So, ladies and gentlemen, you have been warned. If that is your intention, go ahead. But if you want to reduce to the maximum your impulse buying, it may be just as well to lose the credit card. So, there we go. All right, we've got just a few minutes left here. I'll see if I've got any more immediate emails. One from Steve Kruger. Which is a little bit old. I apologize, Steve, but here goes. "Richard, about 2 weeks back, we were on the checkout line in ShopRite, and the woman in front of us had a huge load in her cart. She was moving slowly, not with it, so I looked her over for a quick assessment of her position in the food chain of life. I thought her to be about 35 years old, thin, poorly done hair, and very bad teeth. On I went with my guessing game. Will she pay by cash, check, or charge? No question in my mind, charge was the clear choice. The flat screen showed her total, $218. She promptly pulled out her card and swiped it. You would say, good call of the charge card. Not quite. The card was not a charge card. It was a food stamp card. I glanced back at the screen, and between the food stamp card and a large handful of coupons, she had to come up with $14 cash. So I not only lost my little game, she paid cash, my tax dollars picked up $185 of her tab. It turns out I am quite a sport after all. Our tab was $201, out of which I got to pay the entire bill. So much for games on the checkout line. Now I move robotically through the line, no games. Richard, it's hard to imagine what shape the country would be in if the 47 million food stamp recipients had no access to food. We would have had riots many years ago. You have to think that if King Louis had food stamps, it might not have misplaced his head. Like any government solution, food stamps will just kick the can down the road. God, I hate that phrase. If the dollar fails, the 47 million will be without food, and if the dollar is not accepted as money, the rest of us will also be hungry. All the ingredients for a revolt. Food stamps assure that we will fall from a higher level. Note of little importance, food stamps have been changed to Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, as in snap your back. And you don't have to apply in person. They'll take care of you online. It seems they're every bit as accommodating as the Postal Service. Thank you for the wake-up call. It becomes more relevant each week. Steve Kruger. P.S. One day even Jonathan may have an oh-shit moment and say, I got it. All right. Well, one more quick email from Patrick Winchester. I just got through the beginning of the show in the archive. I think you misunderstood me when I say I fight for my country. I mean fight against all the things that you said it's doing. Don't let it continue to rape us. I mean fight for the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence. I mean get our government to lay off criminal behavior and bring it under control. I don't want the government to do anything for me. Just leave me alone. That's what I mean when I say fight for your country. Of course, the Asian countries own the debt that we owe. It's a huge problem. China will end up owning all of American industry and even our highways. And such, we know that China is the model for the New World Order and that the United States needs to be brought into servitude. That's what I'm talking about. Sure, Switzerland is expensive. I wouldn't go there either. I've just seen some very awake people there. So I think we agree on that. I'm sure there are some fine places to go, but if I'm right about the way things are going, world war and global financing dictatorship will affect a whole lot more people than just those in the U.S. and China. Patrick Winchester. Well, Patrick, I'm afraid you're probably right about that. But, as things keep going in their current direction or get worse from a reduction of a lot of the government spending that for the cost. All of the numbers related to disproportionate wealth distribution are just going to get worse. The ordinary working people will keep losing jobs, replacing them whenever they can with lower paying jobs. I think that housing could fall at least another 60% from current levels with or without government action. And this is supported by a recent report from the U.S. Census Bureau that the number of vacant housing units jumped to 15 million in 2010, up from 10.4 million in 2000. The U.S. will buy more from China. Companies will just keep doing more things overseas and continue to pay tax gains to minimize their U.S. taxes. More and more people will be unemployed for so long that they become virtually unemployable. The proportion of people actively in the workforce will continue to decline, wasting the nation's most valuable resource. Social unrest will grow as the number of have-nots keeps growing. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, it remains for me to wish you a wonderful Thanksgiving. Have a great weekend. I'll be back with you in the middle of it all on Friday. Until then, take care. See you soon. Bye-bye.